On the political right, there is the establishment, the money and big business, and the myriad groups it finances. On the left, there are the minorities, labor unions, school teachers, and the trial lawyers. Only the trial lawyers have money, and it's pocket change compared with big business. Though there were times when Wes wanted to choke them as a whole, he felt at home here. These were his colleagues, his fellow warriors, and he admired them. They could be arrogant, bullish, dogmatic, and they were often their own worst enemies. But no one fought as hard for the little guy. As they lunched on cold chicken and even colder broccoli, the chairman of the Legislative Affairs Committee delivered a rather bleak update on various bills that were still alive over at the Capitol. The tort reformers were back and pushing hard to enact measures designed to curtail liability and close courthouse doors. He was followed by the chairman of political affairs, who was more upbeat. Judicial elections were in November, and though it was too early in the year to be sure, it appeared as though their good judges at both the trial and the appellate levels would not draw serious opposition. After frozen pie and coffee, Wes Peyton was introduced and received a rousing welcome. He began by apologizing for the absence of his co-counsel, the real brains behind the Bowmore litigation. She hated to miss the event, but believed she was needed more at home with the kids. Wes then launched into a long recap of the Baker trial, the verdict, and the current state of other lawsuits against Crane Chemical. Among such a crowd, a $41 million verdict was a much-revered trophy, and they could have listened for hours to the man who obtained it. Only a few had felt firsthand the thrill of such a victory, and all of them had swallowed the bitter pill of a bad verdict. When he finished, there was another round of boisterous applause, then an impromptu question and answer session. Which experts had been effective? How much were the litigation expenses? Wes politely refused to give the amount. Even in a room of big spenders, the sum was too painful to discuss. What was the status of settlement talks, if any? How would the class action affect the defendant? What about the appeal? Wes could have talked for hours and kept his audience. Later that afternoon, during an early cocktail hour, he held court again, answering more questions, deflecting more gossip. A group that was circling a toxic dump in the northern part of the state descended on him and wheedled advice. Would he take a look at their file? Recommend some experts? Come visit the site? He finally escaped by going to the bar, and there he bumped into Barbara Mellinger, the savvy and battle-weary executive director of the MTA and its chief lobbyist.
"Got a minute?"
she asked, and they retreated to a corner where no one could hear them.
"I've picked up a frightening rumor," she said, sipping gin and watching the crowd.
Mellinger had spent 20 years in the halls of the Capitol and could read the terrain like no other, and she was not prone to gossip. She heard more than anyone, but when she passed along a rumor, it was usually more than just that.
"They're coming after McCarthy," she said.
"They?" Wes was standing next to her, also watching the crowd.
"The usual suspects. Commerce Council and that group of thugs.
They can't beat McCarthy."
"Well, they can certainly try."
"Does she know it?" Wes had lost interest in his diet soda.
"I don't think so. No one knows it."
"Do they have a candidate?"
"If they do, I don't know who it is. But they have a knack for finding people to run."
What exactly was Wes supposed to say or do? Campaign funding was the only defense, and he couldn't contribute a dime.
"Do these guys know?" he asked, nodding at the little pockets of conversation. "Not yet. We're lying low right now, waiting. McCarthy typically has no money in the bank. The Supremes think they're invincible, above politics and all that, and by the time an opponent pops up, they've been lulled to sleep."
"You got a plan?"
"No, it's wait and see for now, and pray that it's only a rumor. 2 years ago in the McElwain race, they waited until the last minute to announce, and by then they had $1 million plus in the bank."
"But we won the race."
"Indeed.
But tell me you were not terrified.
Beyond terrified.
An aging hippie with a ponytail lurched forward and boomed,
"Y'all kick the asses down there!"
His opening gave every impression that he would consume at least the next half hour of Wes's life. Barbara began her escape.
"To be continued," she whispered.
Driving home, Wes savored the occasion for a few miles, then slipped into a dark funk over the McCarthy rumor. He kept nothing from Mary Grace, and after dinner that night, they slipped out of the apartment and went for a long walk. Ramona and the children were watching an old movie. Like all good lawyers, they had always watched the Supreme Court carefully. They read and discussed every opinion, a habit they started when their partnership began, and one they clung to with conviction. In the old days, membership on the court changed little. Openings were created by deaths, and the temporary appointments usually became permanent. Over the years, the governors had wisely chosen the fill-ins, and the court was respected. Noisy campaigns were unheard of. The court took pride in keeping politics out of its agenda and rulings. But the genteel days were changing.
"But we beat 'em with McIlwain," she said more than once.
"By 3,000 votes.
It's a win."
2 years earlier, when Justice Jimmy McIlwain got himself ambushed, the Paytons had been too mired in the Bowmore litigation to contribute financially. Instead, they had devoted what little spare time they had to a local committee. They had even worked the polls on election day.
"We've won the trial, Wes, and we're not losing the appeal," she said.
"Agreed."
"It's probably just a rumor."
The following Monday afternoon, Ron and Doreen Fisk sneaked away from Brookhaven and drove to Jackson for a late meeting with Tony Zachary. There were some people they needed to meet. It had been agreed that Tony would serve as the official director of the campaign. The first person he brought into the conference room was the proposed director of finance, a sharply dressed young man with a long history of statewide campaigns in a dozen states, no less. His name was Vancona, and he quickly and confidently laid out the basic structure of their financial plan. He used a laptop and a projector, and everything was flashed against a white screen in vivid color. On the income side, the coalition of supporters would contribute $2.5 million. Many of these were the folks Ron had met in Washington, and for good measure, Vancona presented a long list of groups. The names were a blur, but the sheer number was impressive. They could expect another $500,000 from individual donors around the district, monies that would be generated when Ron hit the stump and began to win friends and impress folks.
"I know how to raise the money," Vancona said more than once, but without being offensive.
$3 million was the magic number, and it virtually guaranteed a win. Ron and Doreen were overwhelmed. Tony watched them carefully. They weren't stupid. They were just as easily misled as anyone else would be under the circumstances. They asked a few questions, but only because they had to. On the expense side, Vancona had all the numbers. Television, radio, and newspaper ads. Direct mail, travel, salaries. His would be $90,000 for the venture. Office rental, all the way down to bumper stickers, yard signs, billboards, and rental cars. His grand total was $2.8 million, which left some wiggle room. Tony slid over two thick binders, each majestically labeled Supreme Court, Southern District, Ron Fisk versus Sheila McCarthy, confidential.
"It's all in there," he said.
Ron flipped some pages, asked a few benign questions. Tony nodded gravely, as if his boy had genuine insight. The next visitor, Vancona stayed in the room, a member of the team now, was a saucy 60-year-old woman from D.C. whose specialty was advertising. She introduced herself as Cat something or other. Ron had to glance at his notebook to confirm. Broussard. Next to her name was her title, Director of Advertising.
Where had Tony found all these people? Kat was filled with big city hyperactivity. Her firm specialized in state races and had worked in over 100. "What's your winning percentage?" Ron wanted to ask, but Kat left few openings for questions. She adored his face and voice and felt confident they would put together the visuals that would adequately convey his depth and sincerity. Wisely, she spent most of her time looking at Doreen as she talked, and the girls connected. Kat took a seat. Communications would be handled by a Jackson firm. Its boss was another fast-talking lady named Candace Groom, and not surprisingly, she had vast experience in these matters. She explained that a successful campaign must coordinate in communications at all times. "Loose lips sink ships," she chirped. "They also lose elections." The current governor was a client, and she saved the best for last. Her firm had represented Senator Rudd for over a decade. Enough said. She yielded the floor to the pollster, a brainy statistician named Tedford, who managed to claim in less than 5 minutes that he had correctly predicted the outcome of virtually every race in recent history. He was from Atlanta. If you're from the big city of Atlanta and you find yourself in the outback, then it's important to remind everyone there that you are indeed from Atlanta. After 20 minutes, they were tired of Tedford. The field coordinator was not from Atlanta, but from Jackson. His name was Hobbs, and Hobbs looked vaguely familiar, at least to Ron. He boasted that he had been running successful campaigns in the state, sometimes out front, sometimes in the background, for 15 years. He threw out the names of his winners without a thought of mentioning his losers. He preached about the necessity of local organization, grassroots democracy, knocking on doors, turning out the vote, and so on. He had an oily voice, and at times his eyes glowed with the fervor of a street preacher. Ron disliked him immediately. Later, Doreen would admit she found him charming. 2 hours after the parade began, Doreen was almost catatonic, and Ron's notepad was bristling with the drivel he wrote in an effort to remain engaged. The team was now complete. 5 well-paid professionals, 6 including Tony, but his salary would be covered by judicial vision. Ron, poring through his notebook while Hobbs was ranting, found the column that projected professional salaries at $200,000 and consultants at $175,000. He made a note to quiz Tony about these amounts later. They seemed much too high, but then what did he know about the ins and outs of a high-powered campaign? They broke for coffee, and Tony herded the others out of the room. They left with warm farewells, excitement about the thrilling race ahead, and promises to meet again as soon as possible. When Tony was alone again with his clients, he suddenly looked tired.
"Look, I know this is a lot. Forgive me, but everybody is busy and time is crucial. I thought one big meeting would work better than a bunch of smaller ones."
"No problem," Ron managed to say. The coffee was working.
"Remember, this is your campaign," Tony continued straight-faced.
"Are you sure about that?" Doreen asked. "Doesn't really feel like it."
"Oh, yes, Doreen. I've assembled the best team available, but you can cut any one of them right now. Just say the word, and I'll be on the phone finding a replacement. Someone you don't like?"
"No, it's just that..." "It's overwhelming," Ron admitted. "That's all."
"Of course it is. It's a major campaign."
"Major campaigns don't have to be overwhelming. I realize I'm a novice here, but I'm not naive. 2 years ago in the McIlwain race, the challenger raised and spent about $2 million and ran a great race. Now we're tossing around numbers that are far more than that. Where is the money coming from?" Tony snapped on his reading glasses and reached for a binder.
"Well, I thought we covered that," he said. Vancona went over the numbers.
"I can read, Tony," Ron shot across the table. "I see the names and amounts. That's not the question. I want to know, why these people are willing to pony up $3 million to support someone they've never heard of. Tony slowly peeled off his reading glasses with an air of exasperation.
Ron, haven't we covered this a dozen times? Last year, Judicial Vision spent almost $4 million to elect a guy in Illinois. We spent close to $6 million in Texas. These numbers are outrageous, but winning has become very expensive.
Who's writing the checks?
The folks you met in Washington, the economic development movement, the conservative Christians, doctors who are being abused by the system. These are people who are demanding change, and they are willing to pay for it.
Ron drank some more coffee and looked at Doreen. A long, silent moment passed. Tony reshifted, cleared his throat, and said softly,
"Look, if you want out, just say the word. It's not too late."
"I'm not quitting, Tony," Ron said, "but this is too much for one day. All these professional consultants and..."
"I'll handle these people. That's my job. Yours is to hit the stump and convince the voters you're the man."
"The voters, Ron and Doreen, will never see these people. They will never see me, thank God.
You are the candidate. It's your face, your ideas, your youth and enthusiasm that will convince them. Not me. Not a bunch of staff members."
Fatigue overcame them, and the conversation lagged. Ron and Doreen gathered up the bulky notebooks and said their goodbyes. The drive home was quiet, but not unpleasant. By the time they drove through an empty downtown Brookhaven, they were once again excited by the challenge. The Honorable Ronald M. Fisk, Justice, Mississippi Supreme Court. Chapter 16. Justice McCarthy eased into her office late Saturday morning and found it deserted. She flipped through her mail as she turned on her computer. Online at her official email address, there was the usual court business. At her personal address, there was a note from her daughter confirming dinner that night at her home in Biloxi. There were notes from two men, one she'd been dating and one who was still a possibility. She wore jeans, sneakers, and a brown tweed riding jacket her ex-husband gave her many years ago. There was no weekend dress code at the Supreme Court because only the clerk showed up. Her chief clerk, Paul, materialized without a sound and said, "Good morning."
"What are you doing here?" she asked.
"The usual. Reading briefs."
"Anything of interest?"
"No."
He tossed a magazine on her desk and said, "This one is on the way. Could be fun."
"What is it?"
"The big verdict from Cancer County. $41 million. Bowmore."
"Oh, yes," she said, picking up the magazine. "Every lawyer and judge in the state claimed to know someone who knew something about the Baker verdict. The coverage had been extensive during the trial, and especially afterward. It was often discussed by Paul and the other clerks. They were already watching it, anticipating the arrival in a few months of the appellate briefs." The article covered all aspects of the Bowmore waste site and the litigation it created. There were photos of the town desolate and boarded up, photos of Mary Grace peering at the razor wire outside the Crane plant and sitting with Jeanette Baker under a shade tree, each holding a bottle of water. Photos of 20 of the alleged victims, blacks, whites, kids, and old folks. The central character, though, was Mary Grace, and her importance grew as the paragraphs flew by. It was her case, her cause. Bowmore was her town, and her friends were dying. Sheila finished the article and was suddenly bored with the office. The drive to Biloxi would take 3 hours. She left without seeing another person and headed south in no particular hurry. She stopped for gas in Hattiesburg and, on a whim, turned east, suddenly curious about Cancer County. When she presided over trials, Judge McCarthy often sneaked to the scene of the dispute for a furtive first-hand look at the site. The murky details of a tanker collision on a busy bridge became much clearer after she spent an hour on the bridge alone at night
at the precise moment of the accident. In a murder case, the defendant's claim of self-defense was discounted by her after she ventured into the alleyway where the body was found. A light from a warehouse window glared down, illuminating the spot. During the trial of a wrongful death at a railroad crossing, she drove the street night and day, twice stopping for trains, and became convinced the driver was at fault. She kept these opinions to herself, of course. The jury was the trier of fact, not the judge. But a strange curiosity often attracted her to the scene. She wanted to know the truth. Beaumore was as bleak as the article said. She parked behind a church 2 blocks from Main Street and took a walk. It was unlikely that she would see another red BMW convertible in the town, and the last thing she wanted was attention. Even for a Saturday, traffic and commerce were slow. Half the storefronts were boarded up, and only a few of the survivors were open. A pharmacy, a discount store, a few other retail merchants. She paused at the office of F. Clyde Hardin and Associates. He was mentioned in the article. As was Babe's coffee shop, where Sheila took a stool at the counter in anticipation of learning something about the case. She would not be disappointed. It was almost 2 p.m. and no one else was at the counter. Two mechanics from the Chevrolet place were having a late lunch in a front booth. The diner was quiet, dusty, in need of paint and refinished floors, and apparently hadn't changed much in decades. The walls were covered with football schedules dating back to 1961, class pictures, old newspaper articles, anything anybody wanted to display. A large sign announced, "We use only bottled water." Babe appeared across the counter and began with a friendly, "What would you like, dear?" She wore a starched white uniform, spotless burgundy apron with Babe embroidered in pink, white hose, and white shoes, and could have stepped out of a 1950s movie. She had probably been around that long, though her teased hair was still aggressively colored. It almost matched her apron. She had the wrinkled eyes of a smoker, but the wrinkles were no match for the thick layer of foundation Babe caulked on every morning.
"Just some water," Sheila said.
She was curious about the water. Babe performed most of her tasks while gazing forlornly at the street through the large windows. She grabbed a bottle and said,
"You're not from around here."
"Just passing through," Sheila said. "I have some kinfolks over in Jones County." And it was true. A distant aunt, one she had thought might still be alive, had always lived next door in Jones County. In front of her, Babe placed a 6-ounce bottle of water with the simple label, "Bottled for Beaumore." She explained that she too had kinfolks in Jones County. Before they went too far down the genealogical road, Sheila hastily changed subjects. In Mississippi, sooner or later, everyone is related.
"What's this?" she asked, holding the bottle.
"Water," Babe said with a puzzled look.
Sheila held it closer, allowing Babe to take charge of the conversation.
"All our water here in Beaumore is bottled, trucked in from Hattiesburg. Can't drink the stuff they pump here. It's contaminated."
"Where are you from?"
"The coast. You ain't heard about the Beaumont water?"
"Sorry." Sheila unscrewed the cap and took a swig.
"Tastes like water," she said.
"You ought to taste the other stuff."
"What's wrong with it?"
"Good Lord, honey,"
Babe said and glanced around to see if anyone else had heard this shocking question. There was no one else, so Babe popped the top on a diet soda and sidled up to the counter.
"You ever heard of Cancer County?"
"No."
Another look of disbelief.
"That's us. This county has the highest rate of cancer in the country because the drinking water is polluted. There used to be a chemical plant here, Crane Chemical, bunch of smart boys from New York. For many years, 20, 30, 40, depending on who you believe, they dumped all kinds of toxic crap, pardon my language, into some ravines behind the plant. Barrels and barrels, drums and drums, tons and tons of the crap went into the pit. And it eventually filtered into an underground aquifer that the city, run by some real dunces, mind you, built a pump over back in the late 80s. The drinking water went from clear to light gray to light yellow. Now it's brown. It began smelling funny, then it began stinking. We fought with the city for years to clean it up, but they stonewalled us. Boy, did they ever. Anyway, the water became a huge fight, and then, honey, the bad stuff started. Folks started dying. Cancer hit like the plague around here. Folks were dying right and left. Still are. Inez Perdue succumbed in January. I think she was number 65, something like that. It all came out in the trial. She paused to examine two pedestrians who were strolling along the sidewalk. Sheila carefully sipped the water. "There was a trial?" she asked. "You ain't heard of the trial either?" Sheila gave an innocent shrug and said again, "I'm from the coast." "Oh, boy." Babe switched elbows and leaned on the right one. "For years, there was talk about lawsuits. I get all the lawyers in here for the little coffee chats, and no one taught those boys how to whisper. I heard it all. Still hearing it. Big talk for a long time. They're going to sue Crane Chemical for this and for that, but nothing happened. I think that the suit was just too big. Plus, you taking on a big chemical company with lots of money and lots of slick lawyers. The talk died down, but the cancer didn't. Kids were dying of leukemia. Folks with tumors in their kidneys, liver, bladder, stomach, and honey, it's been awful. Crane made a fortune off a pesticide called Pillamar 5, which was outlawed 20 years ago. Outlawed here, but not down in Guatemala and places like that. So they kept making Pillamar 5 here, shipping it off to the banana republics where they sprayed it on their fruits and vegetables and then shipped them all back here for us to eat. That came out in the trial, too. And they tell me it really ticked off the jury. Something sure ticked them off. Where was the trial? You sure you don't have any kin folks here? I'm sure. Any friends here in Beaumont? None. And you ain't no reporter, are you? Nope. I'm just passing through.
Satisfied with her audience, Babe took a deep breath and plunged on.
They moved it out of Beaumont, which was a smart move because any jury here would have handed down a death penalty for Crane and the crooks who run it. And they tried the case over in Hattiesburg. Judge Harrison, one of my favorites. Carey County is his district, and he's been eating here for many years. He likes the ladies, but that's okay. I like the men. Anyway, for a long time, the lawyers just talked, but no one would dare take on Crane. Then a local girl, a young woman, mind you, one of our own, said to hell with it and filed a massive suit. Mary Grace Payton grew up a mile out of town. Beaumont High School class valedictorian. I remember when she was a kid. Her daddy, Mr. Truman Shelby, still comes in from time to time. I love that girl. Her husband is a lawyer, too. They practiced together in Hattiesburg. They sued for Jeanette Baker, sweet girl, whose husband and little boy died of cancer 8 months apart. Crane fought like hell and had 100 lawyers, according to the traffic. The trial lasted for months and damn near broke the patents, from what I hear. But they won. Jury threw the book at Crane, $41 million. I can't believe you missed it. How could anyone miss it? It put Beaumont on the map. You want something to eat, honey? How about a grilled cheese? You got it.
Babe threw two pieces of white bread on the grill without missing a beat.
Case is on appeal, and I pray every night that the Paytons will win. And the lawyers are back sniffing around, looking for new victims. Ever hear of Clyde Harden?
Never met him.
He's 7 doors down on the left. Been here forever. A member of my 830 club. A bunch of blowhards. He's okay, but his wife's a snot. Clyde is afraid of the courtroom, so he hooked up with some real shysters from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, not Mississippi. And they filed a class action on behalf of a bunch of deadbeats who were trying to join the parade. Rumor has it that some of their so-called clients don't even live here. They're just looking for a check.
She unwrapped two slices of processed cheddar and placed them on the hot bread.
Mayonnaise? No. How about some fries? No, thanks. Anyway,
the town's split worse than ever. The folks who are really sick are angry at these new victims who are just claiming to be. Funny what money does to some folks. Always looking for a handout. Some of the lawyers think Crane will finally give in and make a big settlement. Folks will get rich. Lawyers will get even richer. But others are convinced Crane will never admit any wrongdoing. They never have. 6 years ago, when the lawsuit talk was hot, they simply folded up one weekend and fled to Mexico, where I'm sure they're free to dump and pollute all they want to, probably killing Mexicans right and left. It's criminal what that company did. It killed this town.
When the bread was almost black, she put the sandwich together, sliced it in two, and served it with a slice of dill pickle. What happened to the Crane employees?
Got screwed. No surprises there. A lot of them left the area to find work. Ain't much in the way of jobs around here. Some were nice folks, others knew what was happening and kept quiet. If they squealed, they'd get fired. Mary Grace found some of them and hauled them back for the trial. Some told the truth, some lied, and Mary Grace ripped them to pieces, according to what I hear. I never watched the trial, but I got reports almost daily. The whole town was on pins and needles. There was a man named Earl Crouch who ran the plant for many years, made good money, and rumor has it that Crane bought him off when they tucked tail. Crouch knew all about the dumping, but during his deposition, he denied everything. Lied like a dog. That was 2 years ago. They say that Crouch has disappeared under mysterious circumstances. Mary Grace couldn't find him to come testify at the trial. He's gone. AWOL. Not even Crane could find him. She left this rich little nugget hang in the air for a moment as she sauntered over to check on the Chevrolet mechanics. Sheila chewed on the first bite of the sandwich and pretended to have little interest in the story. "How's it grilled cheese?" Babe asked when she was back. "Great." Sheila took a sip of water and waited for the narrative to continue. Babe leaned in closer and lowered her voice. "There's a family over in Pine Grove, the Stones. Tough bunch. In and out of prison for stealing cars and such. Not the kind of folks you'd want to start a fight with. 4, maybe 5 years ago, one of the little Stone boys caught cancer and died quick. They hired the Paytons and their suit is still pending. What I hear is that the Stones found Mr. Earl Crouch somewhere out in Texas and got their revenge. Just a rumor, and folks here ain't talking about it. Wouldn't surprise me, though. Nobody messes with the Stones. Feelings are raw, very raw. You mention Crane Chemical around here, people want to fight."
Sheila wasn't about to mention it, nor was she about to pry much deeper. The mechanic stood, stretched, went for the toothpicks, and headed for the cash register. Babe met them there and insulted them as she took their money, about $4 each. Why were they working on a Saturday? What did their boss think he was accomplishing? Sheila managed to choke down half the sandwich.
"You want another one?" Babe asked when she returned to her stool. "No, thanks. I need to be going."
Two teenagers ambled in and settled at a table. Sheila paid her bill, thanked Babe for the conversation, promised to stop in again. She walked to her car, then spent half an hour crisscrossing the town. The magazine article mentioned Pine Grove and Pastor Denny Ott. She drove slowly through the neighborhood, around the church, and was struck by its depressed state. The article had been kind. She found the abandoned industrial park, then the Crane plant, gloomy and haunted, but protected behind the razor wire. After 2 hours in Bowmore, Sheila left, hopefully never to return. She understood the anger that led to the verdict, but judicial reasoning must exclude all emotions. There was little doubt Crane Chemical had done bad things, but the issue was whether their waste actually caused the cancers. The jury certainly thought so. It would soon be the job of Justice McCarthy and her 8 colleagues to settle the matter. They tracked her movements to the coast, to her home 3 blocks off the Bay of Biloxi. She was there for 65 minutes, then drove a mile to her daughter's home on Howard Street. After a long dinner with her daughter, son-in-law, and 2 small grandchildren, she returned to her home and spent the night. apparently alone. At 10 on Sunday morning, she had brunch at the Grand Casino with a female acquaintance. A quick check of license plates revealed this person to be a well-known local divorce lawyer, probably an old friend. After brunch, McCarthy returned to her home, changed into blue jeans, and left with her overnight bag. She drove nonstop to her condo in North Jackson, arriving at 4:10. 3 hours later, a man named Keith Christian, white male, age 44, divorced, history professor, showed up with what appeared to be a generous supply of takeout Chinese food. He did not leave the McCarthy condo until 7 the following morning. Tony Zachary summarized these reports himself, pecking away at a laptop he still despised. He had been a terrible typist long before the internet, and his skills had improved only marginally. But the details could be trusted to no one, no assistant, no secretary. The matter demanded the utmost secrecy, nor could his summaries be emailed or faxed. Mr. Reinhardt insisted that they be sent by overnight letter via Federal Express. Part 2. The Campaign. Chapter 17. In the old town of Natchez, there is a slice of land below a bluff near the river known as Under the Hill. It has a long and colorful history that begins with the earliest days of steamboat traffic on the Mississippi. It attracted all the characters, the merchants, traders, boat captains, speculators, and gamblers headed to New Orleans. Because money was changing hands, it also attracted ruffians, vagabonds, swindlers, bootleggers, gunrunners, whores, and every imaginable misfit from the underworld. Natchez was rich with cotton, most of which was shipped and traded through its port under the hill. Easy money created the need for bars, gambling dens, brothels, and flop houses. A young Mark Twain was a regular during his days as a steamboat pilot. Then the Civil War killed river traffic. It also wiped out the fortunes in Natchez and most of its nightlife. Under the Hill suffered a long period of decline. In 1990, the Mississippi legislature approved a bill that allowed riverboat gambling, the idea being that a handful of fake paddle wheelers would churn up and down the river while their cargo of retirees played bingo and blackjack. Along the Mississippi River, businessmen rushed to establish these floating casinos. Remarkably, once the legislation was actually read and analyzed, it was discovered that the boats would not be required to physically leave the shore, nor were they required to be equipped with any type of engine to propel them. As long as they touched the river, or any of its chutes, sloughs, oxbow lakes, man-made canals, or backwaters, the structures qualified as riverboats under the legislation. Under the Hill made a brief comeback. Unfortunately, upon further analysis, the legislation accidentally approved full-fledged Vegas-style casino gambling, and within a few years, this roaring new industry had settled itself along the Gulf Coast and in Tunica County near Memphis. Natchez and the other river towns missed the boom, but did manage to hang on to a few of their engineless stationary casinos. One such establishment was the Lucky Jack. There, at his favorite blackjack table with his favorite dealer, Cleet Coley sat hunched over a stack of $25 chips and sipped a rum and soda. He was up $1,800, and it was time to quit. He watched the door, waiting on his appointment. Coley was a member of the bar. He had a degree, a license, a name in the yellow pages, an office with the word attorney on the door, a secretary who answered the occasional phone call with an unenthusiastic law office, and business cards with all the necessary data. But Cleet Coley wasn't a real lawyer. He had few clients to speak of. He wouldn't draft a will or a deed or a contract at gunpoint. He didn't hang around the courthouse,
and he disliked most of the other lawyers in Natchez. Cleet was simply a rogue. A big, loud, hard-drinking rogue of a lawyer who made more money at the casinos than he did at the office. He had once dabbled in politics and barely missed an indictment. He had dabbled in government contracts and dodged another one. In his early years, after college, he had done some pot smuggling, but abruptly abandoned that career when a partner was found dead. In fact, his conversion was so complete that he became an undercover narcotics officer. He went to law school at night and finally passed the bar exam on his fourth attempt. He doubled down on an 8 and a 3, drew a jack, and collected another $100. His favorite cocktail waitress brought him another drink. No one spent as much time in the Lucky Jack as Mr. Coley. Anything for Mr. Coley. He watched the door, checked his watch, and kept gambling.
"You expecting someone?"
asked Ivan the dealer. "Would I tell you?"
"Reckon not."
The man he was expecting had also escaped a few indictments. They went back almost 20 years, though they were anything but friends. This would be their second meeting. The first had gone well enough to lead to this one. Ivan was showing 14 when he drew a queen and went bust. Another $100 for Cleet. He had his rules. When he won $2,000, he quit, and when he lost $500, he quit. Anything between those limits, and he would play and drink all night. The IRS would never know it, but he was up 80 grand for the year. Plus, all the rum was free. He flipped two chips to Ivan and began the elaborate task of freeing his massive body from the elevated chair.
"Thanks, Mr. Coley," Ivan said.
"Always a pleasure."
Cleet stuffed the rest of the chips into the pockets of his light brown suit. Always brown, always a suit, always with shiny Lucchese cowboy boots. At 6'4", he weighed at least 280, though no one knew for sure. But he was more thick than fat. He lumbered away toward the bar, where his appointment had arrived. Marlin was taking a seat at a corner table, one with a view of the floor. No greetings of any sort, no eye contact. Cleet dropped into a chair and pulled out a pack of cigarettes. A waitress brought them drinks.
"I have the money," Marlin said finally. "How much?"
"Same deal, Cleet. Nothing's changed. We're just waiting on you to say yes or no."
"And I'll ask you again, who is we?"
"It's not me. I'm an independent contractor, paid a fee for a job well done. I'm on no one's payroll. I've been hired to recruit you for the race, and if you say no, then I might be hired to recruit someone else."
"Who's paying you?"
"That's confidential, Cleet. I explained this a dozen times last week."
"You did. Maybe I'm a little dense, or maybe I'm just a little nervous. Perhaps I want answers. Otherwise, I'm not in."
Based on their first meeting, Marlin was doubtful that Cleet Coley would eventually say no to $100,000 in cash in unmarked bills. Marlin had virtually put it on the table. $100,000 to get in the race and stir things up. Coley would make a beautiful candidate. Loud, outrageous, colorful, able to say anything with no concern about the fallout. An anti-politician, the press would follow like ants.
"Here's what I can tell you," Marlin said, with a rare eyeball-to-eyeball glance at Cleet. 15 years ago, in a county far away from here, a young man and his young family returned home from church one night. They didn't know it, but two black punks were in the house, a very nice house, and they were burglarizing the hell out of it. The punks were hopped up on crack, pistols in every pocket, nasty characters. When the young family came home and surprised them, things got out of control. The girls got raped, everybody got a bullet in the head, then the punks set the house on fire. Cops caught them the next day. Full confessions, DNA, the works. They've been on death row at Parchman ever since. Turns out the young man's family has serious money.
His father had a nervous breakdown, went insane, poor guy. But he's back, and he's pissed. He's furious that the punks are still alive. He's livid that his beloved state never executes anybody. He hates the judicial system, and he especially hates the 9 honorable members of the Supreme Court. He, Cleet, is where the money is coming from. It was all a lie, but lying was part of the job. I like that story, Cleet said, nodding. The money is peanuts to him. It's yours if you jump in the race and talk about nothing but the death penalty. Hell, it's a natural. The people here love the death penalty. We got polls that show almost 70% believe in it, and more than that are upset because we don't use it enough in Mississippi. You can blame it on the Supreme Court. It's a perfect issue. Cleet was still nodding. For a week he had thought of little else. It was indeed the perfect issue, and the court was the perfect target. A race would be a hell of a lot of fun.
You mentioned a couple of groups, he said, slugging his double rum.
There are several, but 2 in particular. One is Victims Watching, a tough bunch who've lost loved ones and been chewed up by the system. They don't have a lot of members, but they are committed. Between me and you, Mr. X is also secretly funding this group. The other is the Law Enforcement Coalition, a very legitimate law and order group with some clout. Both of these will jump on board. Cleet was nodding, grinning, watching a cocktail waitress glide by with a tray loaded with drinks.
Such balance,
he said, just loud enough to be heard. I really have nothing else to add, Marlin said without pushing. Where's the money? Marlin took a deep breath and couldn't conceal a smile. In the trunk of my car. Half of it, $50,000. Take that now, and the day you officially announce, you'll get the other 50.
Fair enough.
They shook hands, then both grabbed their drinks. Marlin pulled keys out of a pocket. My car is a green Mustang with a black top, on your left when you leave. Take the keys, take the car, take the money. I don't want to see it. I'll sit here and play blackjack until you return. Cleet grabbed the keys, struggled to his feet, then strutted across the casino floor and out the door. Marlin waited for 15 minutes, then called the cell phone of Tony Zachary.
Looks like we've hooked us one, he said.
He took the money? Tony asked.
The deal is going down now, but yes, you'll never see that money again. I suspect that the Lucky Jack will get its share, but regardless, he's in.
Excellent. This guy's gonna be a scream, you know. The cameras will love him.
Let's hope so. I'll see you tomorrow.
Marlin found a spot at a $5 table and managed to lose $100 in half an hour. Cleet was back, grinning, the happiest man in Natchez. Marlin was certain that his trunk was now empty. They returned to the bar and drank until midnight. 2 weeks later, Ron Fisk was leaving baseball practice when his cell phone rang. He was the head coach of his son Josh's Little League team, the Raiders, and the first game was a week away. Josh was in the back seat with 2 of his teammates, sweaty and dirty and very happy. At first, Ron ignored the phone, then glanced at the caller ID. It was Tony Zachary. They talked at least twice a day.
Hello, Tony, he said.
Ron, you got a minute?
Tony always asked this, as if he were willing to call back later. Ron had learned that Tony was never willing to call back later. Every call was urgent.
Sure.
A bit of a wrinkle, I'm afraid. Looks like the race might be more crowded than we thought. Are you there?
Yes.
Just got it from a good source that some crackpot named Cleet Coley from Natchez, I believe, will announce tomorrow that he's running against Judge McCarthy.
Ron took a deep breath, then pulled onto the street next to the city's baseball complex.
Okay, I'm listening.
Ever heard of him?
No.
Ron knew several lawyers in Natchez, but not this one.
Me neither. We're doing a background check now.
The preliminary stuff is not too impressive. Sole practitioner, not much of a reputation, at least as a lawyer. Got his license suspended 8 years ago for 6 months. Something to do with neglecting clients. 2 divorces, no bankruptcies. 1 DUI, but no other criminal record. That's about all we know, but we're digging.
Where does this fit?
Don't know. Let's wait and see. I'll call when I hear more.
Ron dropped off Josh's friends, then rushed home to tell Doreen. They fretted over dinner, then stayed up late tossing around scenarios. At 10 the following morning, Cleet Coley wheeled to a stop at the edge of High Street, directly in front of the Carroll Garten Justice Building. 2 rented vans were behind him. All 3 vehicles were parked illegally, but then their drivers were looking for trouble. A 6 volunteers quickly spilled out of the vans and began carrying large posters up a few steps to the sweeping concrete terrace that surrounded the building. Another volunteer hauled up a makeshift podium. A Capitol policeman noticed this activity and strolled over to inquire.
"I'm announcing my candidacy for the Supreme Court," Cleet explained at full volume.
He was flanked by 2 beefy young men in dark suits, 1 white, 1 black, both almost as large as Cleet himself.
"You got a permit?" the officer asked.
"Yep. Got it from the Attorney General's office."
The cop disappeared in no particular hurry. The display was put together rapidly, and when it was complete, it stood 20 feet high, 30 feet long, and was nothing but faces. High school graduation portraits, candid snapshots, family photos, all enlarged and in color. The faces of the dead. As the volunteers scurried about, the reporters began arriving. Cameras were mounted on tripods. Microphones were mounted on the podium. Photographers began snapping away, and Cleet was ecstatic. More volunteers arrived, some with homemade posters with proclamations such as, "Vote the liberals out, support the death penalty, and victims have voices." The cop was back.
"I can't seem to find anyone who knows anything about your permit," he said to Cleet.
"Well, you found me, and I'm telling you I have permission."
"From who?"
"One of those assistant attorney generals in there."
"You got a name?"
"Oswald."
The cop left to go find Mr. Oswald. The commotion attracted the attention of those inside the building, and work came to a halt. Rumors flew, and when word reached the 4th floor that someone was about to announce a campaign for a seat on the court, 3 of its justices dropped everything and hustled to a window. The other 6, those whose terms expired in later years, likewise ventured over out of curiosity. Sheila McCarthy's office faced High Street, and it was soon filled with her clerks and staff, all suddenly alarmed. She whispered to Paul,
"Why don't you go down there and see what's up?"
Others from the court and from the Attorney General's office eased down too, and Cleet was thrilled with the mob that was quickly gathering in front of his podium. The cop returned with reinforcements, and just as Cleet was about to give his speech, he was confronted by the officers.
"Sir, we're going to have to ask you to leave."
"Hang on, boys. I'll be through in 10 minutes.
"No, sir. This is an illegal gathering. Disband it now or else."
Cleet stepped forward chest to chest with the much smaller officer and said,
"Don't show your ass, okay? You got 4 television cameras watching everything. Just be cool, and I'll be out of here before you know it."
"Sorry."
With that, Cleet strode to the podium, and a wall of volunteers closed ranks behind him. He smiled at the cameras and said,
"Good morning, and thanks for coming. My name is Cleet Coley. I'm a lawyer from Natchez, and I'm announcing my candidacy for the Supreme Court. My opponent is Judge Sheila McCarthy, without a doubt the most liberal member of this criminal coddling do-nothing Supreme Court."
The volunteers roared with approval. The reporters smiled at their good fortune. A few almost laughed. Paul swallowed hard at this unbelievable volley. The man was loud, fearless, and colorful,
and was loving every second of the attention. And he was just warming up.
"Behind me, you see the faces of 183 people. Black, white, grandmothers, babies, educated, illiterate, from all over the state and from all walks of life. All innocent. All dead. All murdered. Their killers are, as we speak, preparing for lunch up at Parchman on death row. All duly convicted by juries in this state are properly sent to death row to be executed."
He paused and grandly waved at the faces of the innocents.
"In Mississippi, we have 68 men and 2 women on death row. They're safe there because this state refuses to execute them. Other states do not. Other states are serious about following their laws. Since 1978, Texas has executed 334 killers. Virginia, 81. Oklahoma, 76. Florida, 55. North Carolina, 41. Georgia, 37. Alabama, 32. And Arkansas, 24. Even northern states like Missouri, Ohio, and Indiana. Hell, Delaware has executed 14 killers. Where is Mississippi? Currently in 19th place. We have executed only 8 killers, and that, my friends, is why I'm running for the Supreme Court."
The Capitol Police now numbered almost a dozen, but they seemed content to watch and listen. Riot control was not a specialty, and besides, the man was sounding pretty good.
"Why don't we execute?" Cleet yelled at the crowd. "I'll tell you why. It's because our Supreme Court pampers these thugs and allows their appeals to drag on forever. Bobby Ray Root killed 2 people in cold blood during the robbery of a liquor store 27 years ago. He's still on death row, getting 3 meals a day, seeing his mother once a month, with no execution date in sight. Willis Briley murdered his 4-year-old stepdaughter."
He stopped and pointed to the photo of a little black girl at the top of the display.
"That's her. Cute little thing in the pink dress. She'd be 30 years old now. Her murderer, a man she trusted, has been on death row for 24 years. I could go on and on, but the point is well made. It's time to shake up this court and show all of those who have committed murder or who might do so that in this state we're serious about enforcing our laws."
He paused for another boisterous round of applause, one that obviously inspired him.
"Justice Sheila McCarthy has voted to reverse more murder convictions than any other member of the court. Her opinions are filled with legalistic nitpickings that warm the soul of every criminal defense lawyer in the state. The ACLU loves her. Her opinions drip with sympathy for these murderers. They give hope to the thugs on death row. It is time, ladies and gentlemen, to take away her robe, her pen, her vote, her power to trample the rights of the victims."
Paul considered scribbling down some of this, but he was too petrified to move. He wasn't sure his boss voted so often in favor of capital defendants, but he was certain that virtually all of their convictions were affirmed. Regardless of shoddy police work, racism, malice by prosecutors, stacked juries, and boneheaded rulings by presiding judges, regardless of how horribly defective the trial was, the Supreme Court rarely reversed a conviction. Paul found it sickening. The split was usually 6-3, with Sheila leading a vocal but overmatched minority. 2 of the justices had never voted to reverse a capital conviction. 1 had never voted to reverse a criminal conviction. Paul knew that privately his boss was opposed to capital punishment, but she was also committed to upholding the laws of the state. A great deal of her time was spent on death cases, and he had never once seen her substitute her personal beliefs for a strict following of the law.
If the trial record was clean, she did not hesitate to join the majority and affirm a conviction. Cleet did not yield to the temptation of speaking too long. He had made his points. His announcement was a fabulous success. He lowered his voice, grew more sincere, and finished by saying,
"I urge all Mississippians who care about law and order, all who are sick of random, senseless crimes, to join with me in turning this court upside down. Thank you."
More applause. Two of the larger officers moved in close to the podium. The reporters began to throw questions.
"Have you ever served as a judge?
How much financial support do you have?
Who are these volunteers?
Do you have specific proposals to shorten the appeals?"
Cleet was about to begin with his answers when an officer grabbed his arm and said,
"That's it, sir. Party's over. Go to hell,"
Cleet said as he yanked his arm away. The rest of the police contingent scurried forward, jostling through the volunteers, many of whom began yelling at them.
"Let's go, buddy,"
the officer said.
"Get lost."
Then to the cameras he boomed,
"Look at this. Soft on crime, but to hell with the freedom of speech.
You're under arrest."
"Arrest? You arresting me because I'm making a speech?"
As he said this, he gently and voluntarily placed both hands behind his back.
"You don't have a permit, sir," one officer said as two more slapped on the handcuffs. "Look at these Supreme Court guards sent down from the fourth floor by the very people I'm running against. Let's go, sir."
As he moved from the podium, Cleet kept yelling,
"I won't be in jail long, and when I get out, I'll hit the streets telling the truth about these liberal bastards. You can count on that."
Sheila watched the spectacle from the safety of her window. Another clerk standing near the reporters relayed the news via cell phone. That nut down there had chosen her. Paul lingered until the display was removed and the crowd drifted away. Then he raced up the steps to Sheila's office. She was at her desk with the other clerk and Justice McElwain. The air was heavy, the mood somber. They looked at Paul as if he might by chance have some good news.
"This guy's crazy," he said.
They nodded their agreement.
"He doesn't appear to be a pawn for big business," McElwain said.
"I've never heard of him," Sheila said softly. She appeared to be in shock. "I guess an easy year just became very complicated." The idea of starting a campaign from scratch was overwhelming. "How much did your race cost?" Paul asked. He had just joined the court 2 years earlier, when Justice McElwain was under assault.
$1.4 million.
Sheila grunted and laughed. "I have $6,000 in my campaign account. It's been there for years."
"But I had a legitimate opponent," McElwain added. "This guy's a nut."
Nuts get elected. 20 minutes later, Tony Zachary watched the show in his locked office 4 blocks away. Marlon had captured it all on video and was more than pleased to see it again.
"We've created a monster," Tony said, laughing.
"He's good.
Maybe too good.
Anybody else you want in the race?"
"No. I think the ballot is complete at this point. Nice work."
Marlon left, and Tony punched the number for Ron Fisk. Not surprisingly, the busy lawyer answered after the first ring.
"I'm afraid it's true,"
Tony said gravely, then recounted the announcement and the arrest.
"The guy must be crazy," Ron said.
"Definitely. My first impression is that this is not all bad. In fact, it could help us.
This clown will generate a lot of coverage, and he seems perfectly willing to take a hatchet to McCarthy."
"Why do I have a knot in my stomach?"
"Politics is a rough game, Ron. Something you're about to learn. I'm not worried, not right now. We stick to our game plan, nothing changes."
"It seems to me that a crowded field only helps the incumbent," Ron observed. And he was right, as a general rule.
"Not necessarily. There's no reason to panic. Besides, we can't do anything about others who jump in. Stay focused. Let's sleep on it
and talk tomorrow.
Chapter 18. Cleet Coley's colorful launch landed with perfect timing. There was not another interesting story throughout the entire state. The press seized Coley's announcement and beat it like a drum. And who could blame them? How often does the public get to see vivid footage of a lawyer getting handcuffed and dragged away while yelling about those liberal bastards? And such a loud, large lawyer at that. His haunting display of dead faces was irresistible. His volunteers, especially the relatives of the victims, were more than happy to chat with the reporters and tell their stories. His gall in holding the rally directly under the noses of the Supreme Court was humorous, even admirable. He was rushed downtown to central headquarters, and there he was booked, fingerprinted, and photographed. He assumed correctly that his mugshot would find its way to the press in short order, so he had a few moments to think about its message. An angry scowl might confirm the suspicion that this guy was a bit off his rocker. A goofy smile might lead to questions about his sincerity. Who smiles when he's just arrived at the jail? He settled on a simple, blank face with just a trace of a curious glare, as if to say, "Why are they picking on me?" Procedures called for every inmate to strip, shower, and change into an orange jumpsuit, and this usually happened before the mugshot, but Cleet would have none of it. The charge was simple trespass, with a maximum fine of $250. Bail was twice that, and Cleet, his pockets bulging with $100 bills, flashed enough money around to let the authorities know he was on his way out of jail, not the other way around. So they skipped the shower and the jumpsuit, and Cleet was photographed in his nicest brown suit, starched white shirt, paisley silk tie in a perfect knot. His long graying hair was in place. The process took less than an hour, and when he emerged a free man, he was thrilled to see that most of the reporters had followed him. On a city sidewalk, he answered their questions until they finally grew weary. On the evening news, he was the lead story with all the drama of the day. On the late night news, he was back. He watched it all on a widescreen TV in a biker bar in South Jackson, where he was holed up for the night, buying drinks for everyone who could get in the door. His tab was over $1,400, a campaign expense. The bikers loved him and promised to turn out in droves to get him elected. Of course, not a single one was a registered voter. When the bar closed, Cleet was driven away in a bright red Cadillac Escalade, just leased by the campaign at $1,000 a month. Behind the wheel was one of his new bodyguards, the white one, a young man only slightly more sober than his boss. They made it to the motel without further arrest. At the offices of the Mississippi Trial Advocates on State Street, Barbara Mellinger, executive director and chief lobbyist, met for an early round of coffee with her assistant, Skip Sanchez. For the first cup, they mulled over the morning newspapers. They had copies of four of the dailies from the Southern District, Biloxi, Hattiesburg, Laurel, and Natchez, and Mr. Coley's face was on the front page of all four. The Jackson paper reported little else. The Times-Picayune, out of New Orleans, had a readership along the coast, and it ran an AP story with photo, handcuffs, on page 4. "Perhaps we should advise all our candidates to get themselves arrested when they do their announcements," Barbara said dryly with no attempt at humor. She hadn't smiled in 24 hours. She drained her first cup and went for more. "Who the hell is Cleet Coley?" Sanchez asked, staring at the various photos of the man. Jackson and Biloxi had the mugshot, the look of a man who would throw a punch and ask questions after it landed. "I called Walter last night down in Natchez," she was saying. "He says Coley has been around for years, always on the edge of something shady, but smart enough not to get caught. He thinks that at one time he did oil and gas work. There was a bad deal with some small business loans.
Now he fancies himself a gambler, never been seen within 6 blocks of the courthouse. He's unknown.
Not anymore.
Barbara got up and moved slowly around the office. She refilled the cups, then sat down and resumed her study of the newspapers.
He's not a tort reformer, Skip said, though not without some doubt. He doesn't fit their mold. He's got too much baggage for a hard campaign. There's at least one DUI, at least 2 divorces.
I think I agree, but if he's never been involved before, then why is he suddenly screaming about the death penalty? Where does this conviction come from, this passion? Plus, his show yesterday was well organized. He's got people. Where do they come from?
Do we really care? Sheila McCarthy beats him 2-1. We should be thrilled he is what he is, a buffoon, who we think is not being financed by the Commerce Council and all the corporate boys. Why aren't we happy?
Because we're trial lawyers.
Skip turned gloomy again.
Should we arrange a meeting with Judge McCarthy?
Barbara asked after a long, heavy pause.
In a couple of days. Let the dust settle.
Judge McCarthy was up early, and why not? She certainly couldn't sleep. At 7:30, she was seen leaving her condo. She was trailed to the Belhaven section of Jackson, an older neighborhood. She parked in the driveway of the Honorable Justice James Henry McIlwain. Tony was hardly surprised by this little get-together. Mrs. McIlwain greeted her warmly and invited her inside, through the den and kitchen and all the way back to his study. Jimmy, as he was known to his friends, was just finishing the morning papers. McIlwain and McCarthy, Big Mac and Little Mac, as they were sometimes referred to. They spent a few minutes chatting about Mr. Coley and his astounding press coverage, then got down to business.
Last night, I went through my campaign files, McIlwain said as he handed over a folder an inch thick. The first section is a list of contributors, beginning with the heavy hitters and going south. All the big checks were written by trial lawyers.
The next section summarized his campaign's expenses, numbers that Sheila found hard to believe. After that, there were reports from consultants, sample ads, poll results, a dozen other campaign-related reports.
This brings back bad memories, he said.
Sorry, this is not what I wanted, believe me.
You have my sympathy.
Who's behind this guy?
I've thought about it all night. He could be a decoy. He's definitely a nut. Whatever he is, you can't take him lightly. If he's your only opponent, sooner or later, the bad guys will find their way into his camp. They'll bring their money, and this guy with a fat checkbook could really be frightening.
McIlwain had once been a state senator, then an elected chancery court judge. He had fought the political wars. 2 years earlier, Sheila watched helplessly as he was savaged and abused in a bitter campaign. At its lowest point, when his opponent's television ads, later known to be financed by the American Rifle Association, accused him of being in favor of gun control, there is no greater sin in Mississippi. She had told herself that she would never, under any circumstances, allow herself to be so degraded. It wasn't worth it. She would scamper back to Biloxi, open a little boutique firm, and see her grandchildren every other day. Someone else could have the job. Now she wasn't so sure. She was angered by Coley's attacks. Her blood was not yet boiling, but it wouldn't take much more. At 51, she was too young to quit and too old to start over. They talked politics for over an hour. McIlwain spun yarns of old elections and colorful politicians, and Sheila gently nudged him back to the battles she now faced. His campaign had been expertly run by a young lawyer who took a leave of absence from a large Jackson firm. McIlwain promised to call him later in the day and check his pulse. He promised to call the big donors and the local operatives. He knew the editors of the newspapers. He would do whatever he could to protect her seat on the bench. Sheila left at 9:14, drove nonstop to the Garten building, and parked.